You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Baritone Gerald Finley and bass baritone Eric Owens are backstage at Lyric.
And I think in some ways that's why it's a joy to portray these two characters, because you see the public side of them. You see what they had to deal with in the face of the workers and the military constraints that they were forced to work under. And yet they had their own personal journeys as well, and their own personal battles. And for me, that's one of the joys of the opera, is that it's not simply about the bomb. It's about individuals and their own individual struggles.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I'm pleased to introduce this episode on John Adams's opera, Dr. Atomic. Your host is Wynne Delacoma. She's currently an adjunct faculty member at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and she's former music critic of the Chicago Sun-Times. Wynne is interviewing a number of fascinating people associated with our production of Dr. Atomic. She's already spoken to the celebrated director-librettist Peter Sellers and conductor Robert Spano. You can find those interviews on the main podcast page on our website. For this edition, Wynne is talking to baritone Gerald Finley, who stars in the title role of physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, and bass baritone Eric Owens, who is making his Lyric Opera debut as General Leslie Groves, military commander of the Manhattan Project. Before we play the interview, here's a brief synopsis of the opera. Dr. Atomic premiered only 2 years ago. It's the latest example of composer John Adams' ongoing collaboration with Peter Sellers. It's an opera in which scientific achievements collide with unfathomable moral issues. We're in Los Alamos, New Mexico, in 1945, with scientists working feverishly on the government's top-secret Manhattan Project, the development and detonation of the first A-bomb. The brilliant physicists are grappling with incomprehensible responsibility, unleashing the most fearsome weapon humanity has ever known. The characters in the opera are real, as are the consequences brought about by the development of the atomic bomb. Now, on to the interview with Gerald Finley and Eric Owens. I hope you enjoy it.
The first question I'm going to ask, I'm going to plunge right in. How did you prepare for these two roles?
Well, for J. Robert Oppenheimer, there's a wealth of resource, both classified and declassified. A lot of it is, anecdotal, obviously. He had a profound impact on every person that he met. And from that point of view, it's been wonderful to see all the texts and sort of resource books that were describing not only the Manhattan Project, but everything that happened in the formation of the Atomic Energy Commission and so forth after the war. Of course, the challenge for preparing for the opera was to try and find the character of Oppenheimer before the bomb dropped, and how he was involved in the political, the social, and the scientific community of the 20s and 30s. And there's a lot of people that were happy to talk about it, but also a lot of people that weren't happy to talk about it in a lot of the resources. So I had a great time kind of going through all as much literature as possible. I was fascinated that the basis of the libretto is, in fact, you know, hard documentation. I went to Santa Fe and Los Alamos and tried to get a feeling of the location that Oppenheimer was experiencing. I went to the ranch that he stayed at as a younger man to try and feel, you know, where his emotional core might have been. And I didn't go as far as learning Sanskrit as he did.
There are limits to preparation yet.
But I did read a lot of Baudelaire poetry, and I read the Bhagavad Gita, which are fundamental to the part as constructed by Peter Sellers in the libretto. So, yeah, I worked hard, and it was fun. My gosh, it's been fun. Just to really get to know as complex a character and present myself then in face of the other characters who were involved in the story, and they have equally rich histories.
I was going to say that brings us to Mr. Owens and preparing the role of General Groves, who certainly wasn't as high a profile person, but he was the military chief.
Absolutely. I mean, what's so wonderful about doing a character that was alive recently, you know, in the course of how far back operas can go and characters you have to research. I mean, as Jerry was saying, there's just a wealth of information, which is fantastic. It's something you don't necessarily find with other characters, and to be able to go to the library or the bookstore and there's like, wow, there's this book, and it's fantastic. General Groves, for me, he's such a complicated individual, as many of those military types are, and just reading his autobiographical material and then reading what other people had to say about him, they were very different.
How was he complicated?
He was the son of a clergy person, so, you know, there's that whole son of a preacher psychological stuff that he had to deal with, and having to live up to standards, and how he made his own family try to live according to his standards, his wife and his children, and how, you know, his military life and his family life were very similarly structured. And I can just imagine as a child growing up under that sort of thing, it can't be all that pleasant, or, you know, it's almost, you can almost compare it to growing up as the child of royalty, you know, or royalty of the past, you know, of maybe the 19th century, where there was a lot of regimented scheduling, but not a lot of love, per se. So that made for a man who was very complicated, and also he was very hard on himself. He was just as hard on himself as he was on his subordinates in the military and his family. But as we address in the opera, you know, the one thing he can't seem to get a handle on is his weight and his
wonderful aria of his calories.
Aria about calories and chocolate and so forth. I think John and Peter went back and forth as to whether or not to include that little section in the opera, and it's not a conversation that happened historically, but they got this information from looking at diaries that he kept, and he kept these very, very meticulous records of every little thing he ate, and still he couldn't, you know, get a hold of it, and so I think it's nice to show that human side as well as the blustering militaristic.
There's a wonderful point in the opera too when he's railing at the hapless soldier who comes with the bad weather reports.
Yes, he's as if it's his fault. You know, why can't you do something about the weather and
the ultimate control freak?
Absolutely, right. And this sort of King Canute kind of expectations for the elements to be at his, you know, his beck and call. And
I'm wondering, how have your conceptions of the roles changed in the various, now you've sung it how many times?
This is the third time? This will be the third run.
Right. Have you changed your conception of the characters much, or how have they maybe been enriched?
I think as you get to know people in real life, so we've got to know our characters. Peter Sellers has been wonderful in engaging us in that getting to know process. The amount of material that he obviously was going through in preparation for putting libretto and preparation for the staging the opera, he's always happy to refer back to the scenarios that these characters were involved in to reinforce a particular relationship on the set. The relationship that Oppenheimer has with Teller after the war was very well publicized and was very overt in the public eye. And so what we've decided to do is perhaps turn up the heat, if you like, in the scenes between Teller and Oppenheimer in their initial relationship during the Manhattan Project, which may or may not have been the case, but it serves to demonstrate the dramatic tension between these two characters and what they stood for after the war. So that sort of development has been really helpful. It's given the opera a bit more time to grow and mature. And I think, my relationship with Groves has certainly become more clear, I suppose, just as we have become more clear with each other, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In addition to that, I mean, just as time has gone on and we've been able to do it several times, we've become more comfortable with John's music.
Let's talk a little bit about that, about the vocal challenges in that
yeah,
score.
I mean, John's music is just, it's fantastic music, but it doesn't maybe give us the courtesy of sounding as difficult as it actually is. In certain instances, I mean, you'll listen and you don't necessarily hear the meter changes that are sort of a trademark of John's. And so I just remember the first run in San Francisco, really, maybe it took to maybe the fourth or fifth performance where I could sort of let go of that musician part of myself and sort of maybe flow a little more as a character. Because, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, the John's music, it's very difficult to memorize because of all of the meter changes. And so, you know, as a character, you don't want to look like you're standing up there counting, but in a lot of instances, that's what we're up there doing. but to do it over and over again, I think I've got to the point where I can feel the music now, and I trust myself a little more to just go with it, and I know the orchestration now well enough to bring certain elements out in the character that maybe I was a little afraid to because I would lose touch with the conductor or what have you. So I'm happy that we've gotten a chance to do it several times. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about John's commissions. They're usually co-commissioned by several
organizations. I was going to say that's sometimes not the point.
Which is quite rare. So it's it's not a one-off sort of thing, and that's just a wonderful thing to just sort of delve deeper.
I have to ask you about the aria at the end of Act One, Batter My Heart, for Oppenheimer. Oh, what an incredible aria.
Isn't that amazing?
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course, the main question to John, I know, has been, how did this come to you? And he said, well, it just dropped out of the sky. It was just there one day, and it seemed to be exactly what I was looking for. I mean, to have an aria in a contemporary opera be as moving and as passionate and as singable, and which allows the climax of an act to be distilled in a 4.5 minute bit of music where you're mostly being supported by held wind chords, so it's just the voice. And then he introduces the double bass obbligato in it, and then it's interjected with these incredibly energetic, pulsating percussion and high brass. As a relief, it's a beautifully constructed aria, and very exciting to sing, and hard to sing, but very exciting to sing. And I know that it creates a huge amount of exhilaration for the audience as it reaches the climax for the end of the first act.
What is astounding to me, too, is that poem, which is, I think it's this John Donne sonnet, was a poem that Oppenheimer read.
Well, in fact, it's conjectured that it was, in fact, this John Donne poem, which he quoted as saying was the reason he named this test site Trinity, because the opening line is, "Batter my heart, three-personed God." The interesting thing is that actually it is sort of in typical Oppenheimer fashion, because there's nothing, he didn't leave any personal memoirs. And so everything is on observation and anecdotal. So the other facet of Oppenheimer's character was the interest in the Hindu religion with the tripartite Godhead as well. So he had a number of Trinity elements to his life. And from that point of view, it distills Oppenheimer's life, his passion for goodness, for self, taking himself to task, his own failure as a human being, his own genius as a human being, his reflection on what am I doing to myself, to my colleagues, to the world, what am I offering here. So as a poem, it fits perfectly for the opera, and then both poetically and dramatically.
And as a performance, I mean, I'm going to embarrass Jerry here a bit, but it's just something that's just so incredibly special to watch and listen to. I mean, I remember during the San Francisco performances, without fail, during every performance, members of the cast and the dancers and the extras, every time Better My Heart would come around, we'd all come to the wings to watch and listen, because it was such a moving thing for all of us, and we had to experience it every time. I mean Jerry just, he sings it so well and he acts it so well, and it's just, you just can't help but be transported.
My heart, three percent God for you as yet, but knock, breathe, knock, breathe, knock, breathe, shine and see.
One of the wonderful things, thank you for that, Eric, but I think the thing is that it does represent a human's struggle in their own morality, mm-hmm. against, you know, involving themselves in projects which they hope are for good but could be used in a negative and detrimental way against humanity. That's one of the wonderful things about it, is that this particular aria becomes a platform for a performer, for us as individuals, and you know, it's hugely representational. So I mean, it's an honor to sing it, and John, I think, has, you know, made the format incredibly generous.
It's very interesting, because I think one of the reasons people come back to opera over and over again is because the characters, whether it's, you know, from a Handel aria or Wagner or whomever, are archetypes. We see ourselves in them. They sort of sum up the major questions of human existence. Do you see that as possible in contemporary opera? I know you both sing a fair amount. And do you see those roles, the Groves and Oppenheimer, do you see them as sort of archetypes too, or not?
I would say, as far as Oppenheimer is concerned, I mean, he was such a complex character. He had many, many levels. His spiritual level, as I've mentioned, in terms of his interest in the Bhagavad Gita, his poetic and, if you like, romantic nature, which is exposed in the second scene of the first act, and then his absolute determination as a scientist to get things absolutely right and in order. I'd like to think he's a slightly exaggerated version of perhaps everyone. He behaved in extreme ways, but still managed not to have a breakdown just in spite of it. So I think he had this immense charm, he had great talent, and so people might see him as a character kind of slightly overblown, and in a dramatic way you might think that he is over neurotic, or he smokes too much, or he issues cutting comments far too often, but he's very loving, he's very intelligent, he's got such a wide range of things. He's an overblown archetype, I would suppose, of an everyman.
but truly that, I think, is what he was. I know if you read American Prometheus, as I'm sure you have since it came out, he was a very complex, contradictory person.
And I think, I don't know, my observation of General Groves is that Groves embodies somebody who's, again, struggling in this idea of a human being getting things in control and having order in their lives, and that must lead to some sense of satisfaction or happiness. But does it?
What does it? Exactly. I mean, and being in the world that he's in, the military world, I mean, it's just a must. I mean, it, in a way, he has no choice but to, you know, strive for these, for this excellence and this this rigidity of accomplishment and this sort of, you know, not questioning but just following orders. And
I think, though, that is often a sort of a human hope that we can control things. And I have thought when I saw the aria about the calories, mm-hmm. I thought about the conversations that we all have when we're in hospital emergency rooms and something has happened and we really don't know how our loved one is going to do. And we talk about sports, or we talk about the fact that the trains aren't running on time. We talk about stupid things just because it's hard to face.
To face our own thoughts and fears and failures. And
I think that's why the cake or calorie aria is actually marvelously perceived, because suddenly, as you say, we're about to test the atomic bomb, and this banal and yet incredibly moving element of someone's personal struggle.
But also, right, exactly, banal, but also incredibly, you know, significant.
Yes.
And Groves, his own sort of psychology and his own struggle, and that he doesn't really share with anyone. And I think Peter and John making these two have this conversation, I think it sort of shows what kind of relationship I think that there was, you know, that it may not have been publicly, but when they were alone, I think, you know, certain barriers would drop and that they could talk this way.
And I think in some ways that's why it's a joy to portray these two characters, because you see the public side of them. You see what they had to deal with in the face of the workers and the military constraints that they were forced to work under. And yet they had their own personal journeys as well, and their own personal battles. And for me, that's one of the joys of the opera, is that it's not simply about the bomb. It's about individuals and their own individual struggles. As great as they may seem in their accomplishments, you know, they had weaknesses that they were incredibly sensitive and embarrassed about as human beings. And in the end, that's almost the greatest power. And by the end of the opera, of course, when we're transported past the detonation into other people's incredibly personal needs, but then that's why people have to come to the opera to experience that.
That's right. That's right. I have a question about doing new opera. Both of you have roles that reach from Handel, Mozart, on through the standard repertoire, but you also do so much new opera. Why put yourself through all that?
I'm compelled.
I don't think it's such a pleasure and an honor and fun to be in on the ground floor of something, you know, as monumental as an opera, the birth of a new work that hopefully will be around for a long time.
And for me, I mean, for Mozart, his was contemporary opera in his time.
Absolutely.
And Verdi, the Traviata, was completely contemporary. And Puccini was the same. He was writing, you know, wonderful current stories. And for us, it's a challenge for us, I think, in the classical music industry to kind of take contemporary music by the scruff of the neck and go, okay, everyone out there, this is your music. This music relates to your lives now. These stories are for you right now. And Yeah, the presentation, I suppose, within an opera house where there is still an element of distance. There's an orchestra pit. There's a formality.
Yeah.
I think that opera companies throughout the world are getting braver. That they're understanding that actually these are current events. Opera companies are working very hard to do outreach, education, understand that the audiences of today are also the audiences of tomorrow. And, you know, I'm thrilled to be part of contemporary music because I'm working with minds that are dealing with the same issues that I am. And in hearing how they, as artists, create their drama or their passion, you know, I think that's in the end, contemporary opera is still passionate. It still deals with the issues that we all face every day. Mm-hmm. And the language may be a little bit more challenging for us because musical idiom has kind of raced almost ahead with technology and many elements of our life are much faster. We have less time to kind of sit back and contemplate. And I think that may be the biggest resistance to going to a theater for 3 or 4 hours of an evening, is that the challenge for people's attention is monumental.
Well, especially in the world of the soundbite, to add to what Jerry was saying, I think it's, you know, new works are essential to the survival of the art form. You know, you may get the naysayers, you know, who think that, you know, everything that's worth performing, you know, was written before 1920 and, you know, Puccini and before. But, I mean, if you go back and you read what critics were saying when Puccini and Strauss and Stravinsky were presenting pieces for the first time that we all consider masterpieces today, you'll see that, you know, there's no great music that was written, you know, after, you know, 1850, and then you go back to 1850, it's like, you know, wow, what are these kids writing today?
This is Give me some awful. Gluck.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's, I get a great satisfaction of, you know, being a part of a new work, you know, especially, you know, with my instrumental background and just sort of the joy of hearing new sounds coming from the orchestra and looking forward to the future. And, you know, I think it's exciting. I love doing it. I know Jerry loves doing it.
I think what's lovely is that a composer like John Adams is taking advantage of all the technological innovations and adding them to the sound world that people are experiencing. So there are, in fact, some people may be more familiar with the electronics than they are with the classical setup of the orchestra as it is.
Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.